From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Joseph Heller, the novelist who became famous for his absurdist vision of war, Catch-22. Also today, I speak with writer Jane Rule. When she started writing in the 1960s, she was one of the few lesbian authors to write openly about women's relationships. Her 1964 novel, Desert of the Heart, was adapted into the movie Desert Hearts. Champion banjo player Winnie Winston picks a tune for us and plays a song on his other instrument, the pedal steel guitar. And Ken Tucker reviews new home video releases, including the animated version of The Adventures of Tintin, the popular European comic strip. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. The Random House Unabridged Dictionary defines Catch-22 as a frustrating situation in which one is trapped by contradictory regulations or conditions. The expression was coined by Joseph Heller as the name for the ultimate, most absurd military regulation. Heller titled his first novel Catch-22. It was set during World War II and published in 1961. It found its most enthusiastic audience during the Vietnam War, when readers related to the novel's black humor. Heller's subsequent novels include Something Happened, Good as Gold, and God Knows. In 1981, Heller was struck with Guillain-Barré syndrome. This is a virus which attacks the nervous system and paralyzes the body. Heller recovered from the paralysis, although some of his muscles never regained full strength. His recent book, No Laughing Matter, described that period of his life when he was physically helpless. This week, Joseph Heller is a visiting writer at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. He visited our studios earlier today. I asked him about the expression Catch-22.
I don't know where it comes from. I did not begin with that. In writing the first chapter, which was about 8 or 10 pages, I saw an opportunity to put in something, a catch. It comes from the phrase, there's always a catch to something, or there's just one catch. I decided on impulse to give it a number, so it would have the power of an official statute. I didn't know whether I would keep it or not keep it. Then, in contemplating the second chapter and future chapters, I saw other occasions when that could be employed and to become a kind of mysterious philosophy, perhaps explaining events, but if not explaining, if justifying any type of illegitimate action and converting it to legitimate actions. The number itself was of no significance to me, and for the 7 years I worked on it, it was called Catch 18. And then, because Leon Uris was going to publish a novel called Mila 18, and Leon Uris was very famous and I was not, the publishers decided I better get a new title. And it was an editor who called me up one day and suggested, I think I have a number that's better than 18. He said 22, and I said, you're right. And it's better because it does reflect the repetition of dire events which occur throughout the book.
Why did you make it the catch that you did? In other words, the catch being that in order to get out of...
Well, that's just one use of Catch-22. Yeah. The one that's most frequently quoted is that a bombardier doesn't have... A man doesn't have to go into combat if he's crazy, but as soon as he expresses a wish to get out of combat, that's proof of insanity. That's just one. To me, the more frightening one occurs toward the end, when MPs have come in and broken up a house and arrested people and an old woman is left, and when you're Sally and asks them, how did they do it? Why were they allowed to do it? She says, Catch-22. And he said, did they read it to you? He says, no, they don't have to read it to me. And, of course, Catch-22 says they don't have to tell you what Catch-22 is about. And then comes the more dire line that says, Catch-22 says they can do anything to us we can't stop them from doing.
The absurdity of war was an idea really more associated with the Vietnam War than it was with World War II, the war that you were in and the war that Catch-22 is set in. Did you experience it as an absurd war when you were fighting?
No, actually, in talking to students, I have to make a point of stating that Catch-22 was not autobiographical in the sense that the experiences, the emotions and attitudes of Yossari and other sympathetic characters were not my own at the time I was in World War II, and probably were not those of most people in World War II, because there was a uniformity of opinion, a sense of rightness and necessity about fighting World War II, which has not existed since and which has rarely existed in the past in American history. My impression, I was very young, as most Americans were in World War II, 19 or 20. So my impression might be misleading, but there was a sense of governmental efficiency. It might have been inefficient, but it was never silly and never as inhumanly corrupt or devious as the wars or the politics, political statements about the wars have been ever since.
You were a bomber pilot.
I was a bombardier, not a pilot.
Oh, okay.
A bombardier in the B-25s, which were medium bombers. I was overseas at a time when it was very safe, relatively safe for me. When I left, it became dangerous again, and before I got there, it had been dangerous. But I was a bombardier in the B-25.
Did your attitude toward being a bombardier and toward being in the military change as you got deeper into the war?
No, it changed in terms of my own personal experience. I was required to fly 60 missions, and most were relatively easy. In fact, if I went on what was called the milk run at the beginning, I was disappointed. The only thing I knew about war was an impression obtained from Hollywood motion pictures. And if nothing happened, I was disappointed. I wanted adventure. Late in my tour of duty on my 37th mission, I had some adventure. I saw a plane shot down and a man on my plane was wounded. And for the next 27 missions, I was in a state of consternation, which often approached terror.
So but
that did not involve questioning the necessity of that war or fighting that war.
You know, it's interesting to me. A lot of writers write a great war novel during their career. And something about war is that fighting in it gives you kind of great material if you're a writer. On the other hand, half of your generation is experiencing it at the same time. So you have all these other writers writing great novels about war. Was that ever a problem for you, knowing that you might have this great novel about war in you?
No, I didn't. It was not a problem. If anything, the very good, I hesitate to use the word great about any novel, including my own, but the very good and successful war novels were an inspiration for me and a deterrent. Now, we're thinking...
A deterrent
in this way, that Norman Mailer had written The Naked and the Dead almost 10 years before I began Catch-22, and James Jones in 1950 or 51 published the From Here to Eternity. Deterrent in this respect, that I was not going to write a realistic book about World War II because my own experiences were limited. I really don't like doing research. And they, each of them and others, had already done very well what they had done. There was no need for another novel that would duplicate those. So it was a guide to me, and I was seeking a... once I decided to write a novel, I didn't decide to write a novel until I was 30 years old, then the task came of what novel to write. And my major experience then was in World War II, so it would be set in World War II. But the fact that these other writers had done their work so well led me to seek an area in which a novel could be written that had not been, a kind of novel that had not been written, and that was Catch-22, which was inspired more by the post-World War, the attitudes of the post-World War, than by the actual situation of World War II or my own experiences in it.
Writer Joseph Heller is my guest. Catch-22 is your first novel. And it took you several years till your next novel was published. Did you go through a period of thinking, uh-oh, say I never complete the next novel?
No.
Were you ever scared about that?
Nope, not at all. Catch-22's success was modest and very slow in accumulating a reputation. My second novel, Something Happened, was very slow in being completed. It was very much different from Catch-22, in many ways a dangerously experimental novel because... unlike Catch-22, which is filled with action, violence, and comedy, violent comedy, Something Happened is borders on a monotonous situation. And the challenge I had with that and enjoyed was writing a novel that was very deep psychologically. And in which the dramatic elements are muted and yet keep the novel interesting. It was the growing reputation of Catch-22 that gave me the confidence to this extent, the knowledge that whether the book succeeded or failed, it would get a lot of attention from critics and reviewers and would be read very carefully. And something happens to a book that should be read carefully. So Catch-22 was never frightening to me.
I want to ask you about another novel, Good as Gold, which starts off with a college professor who's asked to write a novel, to write a study of the Jewish experience in America. And I wonder if you had ever been approached to write such a book yourself.
Well, the idea for that book came from a question from a woman in Wilmington, Delaware. I was there talking to them and reading to them pretty much the way I'm here at the University of Pennsylvania talking about my works and answering questions or inviting questions. And a woman asked me, why is it you've never written about the Jewish experience in America? And I gave my answer, which is truthful but too long to go into here. And then coming back from Delaware on the train, I began thinking about the question. I was nothing else I wanted to write. And by the time I got off the train, I had the idea for Good as Gold, which begins with my protagonist, Bruce Gold, had been asked many times to write about the Jewish experience, most recently by a woman in Wilmington, Delaware.
It seems to me this was, in a way, a backdoor way for you to write a little bit about the Jewish experience in America without having to write about the Jewish experience in America.
Well, it also coincides with my own experience, because my answer to her was that I didn't feel I was qualified, because my Jewish experience was very much different from my parents and very much different from Bernard Malamud's and Philip Roth's and certainly Isaac Singer and others whose names came to me more readily than they do now.
You mean you didn't feel like you had an official Jewish experience?
Exactly, yes, because I grew up in a neighborhood in which everyone was Jewish. Then I moved into the army where everyone was not Jewish. And that was kind of a revelation. Growing up as a child, you begin to think everybody is Jewish and all parents speak with a Yiddish accent. And after World War II, at least where I lived, which is New York City and on a collegiate level, anti-Semitism decreased. It was no longer fashionable. And no longer fashionable, also no longer normally vicious. The fact that certain clubs exclude people, that's easily tolerated by me.
Well, you weren't going to be members of those clubs
anyway. I do feel, without being anti-feminist, I'm not. I do feel that private groups should have the right to select who they want to. And I think the law in most places do allow them to do that if they don't get tax benefits. But we're moving away. My Jewish experience was largely an American experience and not much different in that area from almost everybody I knew. So what occurred to me was, well, maybe a novel ought to be written or can be written about somebody of my approximate age who was growing up, who grew up in a Jewish neighborhood and after the war was found that his Jewish experience was very largely a metropolitan experience and an American experience. And that's what Good as Gold came to. Now, going beyond that, it was being written in an age when Jews were being accepted. They're still not accepted in certain industries and banking, but were being accepted in government in a high position. A blessing to me was the prominence at that time of Henry Kissinger. So I made very much of him in the book and the effect upon the character.
You know, I want to ask you, since we're talking about the time when you were growing up, you grew up in Coney Island, which is most famous for its huge amusement park, which is kind of past its glory days now. I assume it's still open. I haven't been back there in a long
time. Oh, it's open. But see, what most of the world doesn't know, it's also a very large residential area and has been. I was a mile away from the amusement area, but there was a very large, I don't know what the population figures were, but there was a very large residential Italian population in one part, and the other part was almost entirely Jewish. I mean, there must have been 25,000 or 40,000 or 50,000 families living there and regarded as a neighborhood which had the advantages. Now, it was a low-income neighborhood then, but which had these very precious advantages of a beach, a boardwalk close by, which is most valuable in the spring and autumn and sometimes in the winter, and had this fantastic amusement park there.
Did you have this feeling that, well, most kids have the parachute jump within walking distance?
Yeah, the parachute jump came late in my experience. Native Coney Islanders always looked on that with disdain as being there mainly for tourists.
Oh my goodness.
It was not a particularly exciting ride. I grew up at the time when there were large amusement parks. Luna Park was one and Steeplechase was another. But they were there. And the rites of passage involved growing up, the time you went on the highest roller coaster, which was called the Mile Sky Chaser, and then you went on the most thrilling, which was the Cyclone. And after a while, you're swimming out a quarter of a mile, a half a mile to the bellboy there. That's the way we grew up. In certain rides, we began disdaining it in early years. Just the way if you wanted a hot dog, you went to Nathan's. You didn't go to Feldman's because Feldman's was German, and it didn't have garlic in it. It wasn't smoked.
Do you ever go back to your old neighborhood?
Occasionally. I don't live in New York City now. I live about 2.5 hours away. I go back when a foreign interviewer comes and wants to see where I grew up, so we go there.
Right. I'm speaking with writer Joseph Heller, whose books include Catch-22, Something Happened, Good as Gold, and No Laughing Matter. We're going to talk some more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Writer Joseph Heller is my guest. The one book of nonfiction that you've written that I know of is No Laughing Matter, which is a very personal account of the period that you had Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is something that was responsible for a rather long period of temporary paralysis. Would you just describe a little bit what Guillain-Barré is?
Well, Guillain-Barré is a disease of what's called the peripheral nervous system, which I now know constitutes those nerves which come out of the spinal cord and out of the brain. The tissues are inflamed. As they get inflamed, the nerve responses are diffused. And the muscles become weak. The muscles become weak because they're not being activated. And it leads, in its most extreme cases, to total paralysis, where the person cannot even close the eyelids, and is incapable of talking, and is on a respirator. Mine was a moderate case. There is no known cause for it, although it's often stimulated by a viral infection, although the virus doesn't cause it, which means it often follows inoculations. I did not have inoculations. It was kind of amusing in onset because I did not have any sensory disturbances. Many people get numbness and tingling and then burning sensations. I was paralyzed and needed care for I was in the hospital, two hospitals for close to 6 months, and then it was about another 6 months before I could take care of myself. I left the hospital in a wheelchair and needed my friend Speed Vogel to take care of me, and I hired the most charming of the private nurses I have to take care of me, and we're married now because that worked out beautifully for us. It's a very serious disease, a very expensive disease, and many people do not recover to the extent that I have. And because I was knew I was recovering, and because I was never in pain, and the idea came, I wanted to keep Speed Vogel with me through that winter. And a friend of his suggested, why doesn't he write a book about taking care of me? And he asked me, could he do it? And I said, no, but I think together we can do it. So we wrote alternate chapters of it.
Can I ask you, when you started getting certain symptoms, knowing that something was wrong, the food tasted funny and you had trouble swallowing, had you ever had hypochondriac problems before that, where you could have confused some irrational
fear? No, not at all. No, a fear of disease and a fear of death I've always had, and it's prevalent in all my books, even in most of the most comical of my books, which I suppose would be good as gold. I've never had a hypochondriac. I've never imagined I've had something, and I'm very slow to go to doctors. And when I go to a doctor, I notice something specific, and I delayed with this for 2 days because. Most symptoms I get past, most symptoms most people get. But it reached a point where I unmistakably knew my shoulders were getting weak and the difficulty in swallowing was increasing. And Even at that time, I was jogging regularly, but I noticed in the warm-up exercises they were getting more and more difficult. So I called the doctor with some amusement, and I knew something was going on inside me, and it was something I'd never experienced before. And it was exciting. I felt kind of whimsical about it because there was no fever, no pain of any kind.
You know, in your book, you
and incidentally, I've corresponded or heard from hundreds of people who've had this disease. Mine guessed at the right diagnosis over the telephone, which astounds many people, because sometimes it takes a week. And along with this, many people that I've heard from are usually sent to a psychiatrist because it's something which cannot be verified clinically.
Huh. So they think it's a hypochondriac kind of thing.
Oh, yeah. They think it's some form of hysteria, hysteria in a psychiatric sense.
You know, you describe lying in bed in the hospital and having your friends coming to visit you. One of those friends was Mel Brooks.
Right.
And he basically wanted to know,
is it contagious,
or would he get it?
Well, Mel is, I've known Mel a long time. Mel is acutely, he's not a hypochondriac either, but he is acutely alert to the possibilities of diseases of all kinds, and does really have medical dictionaries, and I believe, in truth, does subscribe to the New England Journal of Medicine and to Lancet, which is the English publication. So his first visit to me, really, he knew more about it than I did then, but I knew enough to know he knew a great deal about it.
Were you offended with him coming in and basically wanting to quiz you to see?
Not at all. Not at all. He was also coming to
I realize that. I realize
that. He's coming as a friend.
Okay. you were initially in the intensive care unit.
Yeah.
Usually when someone's in intensive care, their mind is really dulled, and they're barely conscious. You're one of the few people who had all your wits about you. It was just your body couldn't move.
It is one of the characteristics of this disease that the mind is unimpaired. So in that unit, there were three other beds, and for the 22 days I was there, I'd say for 19, I was the only one with whom the nurses could speak, the only one who was conscious. And it was not a blessing because every other day somebody next to me, of course, would die. There's a man I'm in touch with who was totally paralyzed, meaning he could not speak.
Yeah.
And his description of how the medical personnel would forget that he could hear and reason, and some of the things he observed and the things nurses would talk about, sexual experience, doctors making jocular or sexual advances to nurses, and people talking about what they did the day before in his presence. He described that as among the most humiliating experience of his life, the fact that he was lying there hearing everything and being completely cogent. This struck me while I was in the middle of writing God Knows. And sometimes half in jest, sometimes not so much in jest, people would ask me if I thought God was giving me a warning about God Knows, not to continue writing it. My answer is no, and because there are other people around me who are more severely ill, and in a rehabilitation hospital of the 60 patients on my floor, I was the only one who had a chance of recovering enough to resume a normal life.
You've fully recovered from
I've recovered as much as I'm going to. I have numerous muscular weaknesses, mm-hmm. including pronouncing certain sounds because my mouth was affected and I have trouble certain vowels and consonants which require a pursing of the lips I have to make with a muscular effort. Shoulders are weak, legs are weak, but they don't bother. That weakness does not bother me in the slightest.
I hope this isn't too personal, so if it is, we'll drop it. But I know you married the woman who was your nurse.
Yeah.
Did you have to redefine your relationship after you got well and it was no longer a professional relationship?
I had been married a very long time to my first wife. We had been separated for years. First time in my life I lived alone was resolved. I would never marry again because of my I didn't want to take the trouble learning how to live with somebody. Now, what happened, fortunately for me and Valerie, is that we were together day and night for close to a year. So by that time, the nurse-patient relationship changed very, very gradually, and I knew her very well, and she knew me intimately as a result of taking care of me. No, it didn't change at all.
One of the things you're famous for is your sense of humor in your writing. Do you feel that having had a protracted illness has affected your sense of humor at all?
Not in the least, no.
Do you think it's heightened it?
No, it doesn't affect my humor. It's given me a much healthier attitude toward life. It takes a lot more to get me angry or to make me impatient than it did before. And I'm leading a glorious life now because God knows was finished. Now, I ran out of money while I was sick. It's a very, very expensive illness because it requires a long period of care in a rehabilitation hospital. But when, luckily, my hands came back first, I was able to resume writing. And when God Knows was completed and the publisher liked accepted for publication, from that time on, I'm living a more relaxed, happy life than ever. I do only what I want to do in a way of work, which is to write.
Yeah, have you changed the balance of work to leisure in your life?
No, my leisure is my work.
Uh-huh.
I'm fortunate that I have no interest in athletics and watching it or playing it. I'm bored stiff, as bored by the Olympic Games as I am by the presidential campaigning. But my pleasure is writing, and so in that respect, I'm extremely fortunate.
When your new novel, Picture This, is published in August, it will be the second novel of yours to be published since you got sick. Are you writing quicker now than you used to?
I'm writing quicker because there are fewer distractions. I don't live in Manhattan anymore. I live in East Hampton, which is the country, and live there winter and summer. And it's a leisurely life, and I don't have to do anything anymore other than what I want to do. And since I want to... I spend more time writing, so the books are finished more quickly. I still sit down laboriously and work for 2 hours, hoping to get one page. But out there, I'm now doing that 2 or 3 times a day, so it's going 2 or 3 times more quickly.
Do you ever reread your own books?
I reread it continually until it's published, but I've never been able to read any of my novels after publication the way a reader would read it. After it's published, I'm reading it to see what typographical errors we all overlooked. But I cannot read it the way a reader does because I usually know it's coming, or I regret taking out something that had been taken out.
Let me just ask you one last thing. Why did you want to write? You didn't publish your first novel till you were around 30?
38.
38, okay.
Yeah.
It's pretty mature for a first novel to come out. You'd worked, I think, in advertising before.
I was working. I continued working for a year after Catch-22 was published.
You'd written short stories before that?
Long before, as a college student, yes.
What did you want to write?
Why did I want to write? Nobody knows the answer to that. I think if you asked everybody in the country who reads, would you like to write a book? Almost everybody says, I'd love to write a book, and I do have a book. So that wish is kind of general. I mean, there'd be a psychological explanation for the same reason certain people want to act. I think there's a desire to excel and a desire to excel in a way that commands large attention. We use the word fame for it. And writing is a respectable way to become famous.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well,
thanks for being here.
It's been a pleasure. I wish we had another half hour.
Me too. My guest has been writer Joseph Hiller, and his books include Catch-22 and Something Happened, Good as Gold. One of his recent books is titled No Laughing Matter, and that's an account of the period when he was paralyzed temporarily due to Guillain-Barré syndrome. His latest book is called God Knows, and his next book, Picture This, is due out in August. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with writer Kate Simon. She's best known for her two memoirs of growing up, Bronx Primitive and A Wider World, Portraits in an Adolescence. Her new book is titled A Renaissance Tapestry. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with writer Jane Rule. She started writing novels about lesbians before the dawn of the gay pride movement. Her 1964 novel, Desert of the Heart, was recently adapted into the movie Desert Hearts. Also, we feature Winnie Winston in our weekly performance spot. He'll play a couple of tunes, one on banjo, one on pedal steel guitar. And Ken Tucker reviews The Adventures of Tintin. The star of the European comic strip is now available to American audiences on home video cassette. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green in Washington. Sandinista and Contra negotiators have failed to reach agreement on a ceasefire proposal at the end of 2 days of peace talks in Costa Rica. They did agree today to hold a second round of talks next month in Guatemala. The church-appointed mediator in the talks said the first direct negotiations between the two sides were positive, with both sides willing to seek a ceasefire. At the Vatican today, Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega had a private audience with Pope John Paul II. Ortega is touring European capitals to promote the Central American peace plan. More from Sylvia Pajole.
At a press conference this afternoon, Ortega said his talk with the Pope was constructive and frank. He added that John Paul accepts and supports the Arias peace plan. When Ortega arrived at the Vatican earlier, the Pope's welcome was very cool. The audience followed a period of tension between Nicaragua and the Catholic Church. The Polish-born Pope has criticized the presence of three priests in the Sandinista government and Nicaragua's expulsion of two bishops. Both Ortega and a Vatican spokesman declined to comment whether the Sandinista leader asked that the Vatican pressure the Reagan administration not to seek further aid for the anti-Sandinista Contras. For National Public Radio, this is Sylvia Poggioli in Rome.
Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak wound up a 3-day visit to Washington today as the guest of honor at a State Department luncheon. Talks between Mubarak and U.S. officials apparently did not achieve a breakthrough for Middle East peace. But Secretary of State George Shultz assured Mubarak of U.S. support for Arab-Israeli negotiations and an international Mideast peace conference. At today's luncheon, Mubarak publicly extended an invitation to Shultz to visit Egypt. President Reagan's candidate to head the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency said today he would like to see deep cuts in superpower strategic nuclear arsenals. But Major General William Burns told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that the U.S. would be better off with no treaty than a bad one. And Burns said he would not advise a nuclear test ban without a ban on nuclear weapons.
Senator, I favor that only in the context of the ultimate total elimination of nuclear weapons. From my military background, I believe that testing is essential at some level while we maintain a nuclear arsenal.
Burns was chosen by President Reagan to replace ACDA Director Kenneth Edelman. His nomination must be approved by the Senate. Exactly 2 months after a South African Airways Boeing 747 crashed into the Indian Ocean near the island of Mauritius, the wreckage has been found. NPR's John Madison reports from Johannesburg.
Using a sonar scanner, the U.S. Navy has found the wreckage of South African Airways Flight 295. The plane is about 3 miles below the surface of the sea, and it'll be May or June this year before selected items, including the black box flight recorder, are recovered. That is, if the flight recorder is with the rest of the wreckage. 159 people were on board the plane, and none could have survived the crash. The plane was flying towards Mauritius for a fuel stop en route from Taiwan to South Africa. The cause of the crash is still not known, but officials here have suggested that there may have been a fire in the cargo section. I'm John Madison in Johannesburg.
The Reagan administration today removed Singapore, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and South Korea from the list of countries eligible to export goods to the U.S. without duties. The move goes into effect next January. It affects nearly $10 billion in imports to the U.S. The concessions had been granted to help the countries strengthen their economies. In a statement, the White House said the privilege will be lifted because of their remarkable advancements in economic development. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 28 points to close the week at 1958.22. Advances led declines 5-2. I'm Sharon Green, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Winnie Winston joins us today to play two tunes, one on the five-string banjo and the other on the pedal steel guitar. Winston has won 4 banjo world championships at the Union Grove Old Time Fiddlers Convention. He also performs at the annual Labor Day International Pedal Steel Convention in St. Louis. He's played with Bill Monroe and has recorded with David Bromberg and Steve Goodman.
When I first became interested in five-string banjo, I bought a record called American Banjo Tunes Scruggs Style, named after Earl Scruggs, the great banjo player. And it's a particular style of playing I really wanted to learn, and sat and listened to it over and over again. And this tune is called The Spanish Fandango, and it was the first one which I was able to listen to and say, ah, I know how to do that. I started to play the banjo when I was about 14 years old. I grew up in New York, and being a northern boy, the first time I got my driver's license, went down south to see how it was really done. Banjo being a really traditional American instrument, I somehow was drawn into pedal steel guitar, which is another traditional American instrument. The steel guitar just was giving me the ability to pull off music, which I just couldn't do on the banjo. I kept hearing on the banjo and wanted to play some of this stuff. And a friend of mine told me about the steel guitar, and I said, oh, that's a terrible instrument. And then I started to play it. Here's a tune which I wrote. It's called Springtime Last Time Around. That's what it sounded like to me, so that's what I called it. And here it is.
Thank you.
Winnie Winston is co-author of How to Play Pedal Steel Guitar from Oak Publishing. He lives in an old firehouse in Philadelphia. This is Fresh Air. In 1964, at a time when few writers dared to address the subject of homosexuality, Jane Rule published her first novel, Desert of the Heart. The main character was a woman who, after divorcing her husband, fell in love with another woman. The book was recently adapted into the movie Desert Hearts. Rule has written about lesbian themes in subsequent novels, short stories, and essays. Although born in New Jersey, Vancouver, Canada has been Rule's home since 1956. Her new novel, Memory Board, is about two women in their 60s, a retired physician who is arthritic, and her longtime lover who suffers from memory loss. Rule writes about aging without sentimentality or nostalgia.
I certainly was wanting to focus on people rather than the problem of aging. One of the things that I'm interested in with all my characters is to see them centrally as in their humanness with all the problems and livelinesses that they have. And I don't make an exception for people who are older.
A couple of years ago, your first novel, Desert of the Heart, was made into a movie. Did a lot of new readers discover you through that film?
Yes, it's very exciting. The book I finished nearly 30 years ago. It took quite a while to get it published the first time around. It was published in 1964, and it's been reissued all over the English-speaking world and has a much wider readership than it did in the first place. And it's very exciting to see that the book you wrote that long ago doesn't seem to people out of date but relevant to experience today. So it's been very exciting for me.
Were you out among friends and colleagues when the book was published?
Not officially. You have to remember that in those days you didn't talk about things like that. Certainly among my friends and my family I was, but I was teaching at the University of British Columbia at the time, and someone did bring up the issue after the book came out. And the defense in the department was, you don't have to be a murderer to write murder mysteries. And I think this is a very silly defensiveness, but in 1964, not surprising.
The stakes were really much higher then. There was no gay and lesbian movement. The stakes were much higher, I think, to admit to yourself or to anyone else that you were gay.
Well, it's not very hard to admit if you're in a very happy relationship. In fact, it's something to celebrate, so that it didn't seem to me anything humiliating, just awkwardly private. So that there were social problems about it. You know, we kept being invited to dinner parties with two gay men so that it would all look all right. And it was a totally open secret. But, I mean, you simply dealt in those terms in those days. I got much more restless much earlier than most people, I suppose, and then found myself the only open lesbian in Canada. And therefore, anytime an issue came up, I had to address it. So I became a kind of spokesperson for no movement because there wasn't anybody else out there.
Well, how did you feel being thrust into that role?
Sometimes irritated. I don't really feel that my chief job is educating the world about lesbianism or that it should be necessary, but obviously it is. And I think if you're put on the spot, the one thing you can do about it is to be educative as you can be.
Well, you once said that you hate labels that are used to describe writers. you know, women writer, feminist writer, lesbian writer, but if a label had to be applied to you, you'd like it to be Canadian writer. Why do you feel so strongly about that, and what got you to Canada?
Well, what got me to Canada was discovering Vancouver, which is one of the most beautiful cities in the world. And so it was actually the landscape. But also, I was looking for a way to get out of the United States. And you may not remember, but in the 1950s, McCarthy was requiring loyalty oaths and hunting down homosexuals all across the country and universities and the army. It was a very ugly, ugly time in the United States.
Although the movement, the feminist movement and the gay and lesbian movement has had a lot of really positive effects for you, I think that there, one disadvantage that you've cited is the emphasis on political correctness, which you've always taken issue with.
In a sense, being a writer of fiction, I'm strongly opposed to fiction being used as propaganda for any reason. However, I think that if you present any characters, gay characters, positively, you're accused of propaganda because the spoken and agreed on cliche is that all gay people are sick and miserable. But really, that one line that I must write all my characters to be perfect if they're gay, that comes out of the gay movement, is as silly. We aren't. We come in all different stripes as everyone else does.
Your novels and essays are now available on Naiad Press, which is a gay and feminist publishing company. Now, there was no such thing when you started writing. There weren't these small specialized labels, feminist presses and lesbian presses. Would you prefer to be on, say, a major commercial mainstream publisher?
No, I have been. I've had a number of my books published in the States by mainstream. Harcourt Brace Jovanovich brought out Contract with the World, which is my last novel. They were happy that the first printing sold out in 4 months, didn't reprint, did absolutely nothing to make the book available, to advertise it. And this is what the mainstream presses do. They go for mostly bestsellers, and then in order to make themselves look superficially literary, they will take a novel or two, but they won't do anything about selling it. And beyond that, they don't know how to reach the enormous range of independent bookstores that are now serving special interests.
I would suspect that your readers write you very emotional letters. I'm thinking especially of readers who were first coming out as they started reading you. And it's so exciting to find characters in fiction whose lives reflect in some way your life. And gays have been so marginalized, especially in the past, in our culture, that it's just been impossible to find images of people who were gay. And if you find it, it can be so exciting. So I'm sure you've gotten very personal letters from readers who really wanted to make some kind of emotional contact with you. But it's really hard for an author to pay back emotionally, you know, in the same way that a reader would write in. How have you handled that?
I think it was most difficult for me when Desert of the Heart came out, because, of course, that was a little book out there all by itself without any other books for people to turn to. When you get a letter from a distressed reader or a reader who feels you're the only person in the whole world who understands them, there really isn't very much you can do. You know, when someone is writing you from South America saying they're about to kill themselves and only you can help, it's horrifying. And I think that it was the greatest burden to me after that book came out. I don't get as many distressed letters anymore. I get many more happy, celebrating letters, which are much easier to deal with.
When you were young, did you look for literature that had some evidence of homosexuality in it?
No. I read The Well of Loneliness when I was a kid and was horrified by it.
What horrified you?
Well, I thought, I'm going to have to live in a ghetto and dress up like a man. And I was already 6 feet tall with a deep voice, so, you know, it's just... And I couldn't speak French, and apparently the only people who knew each other were people who lived in Paris, and I, the whole thing just turned me off completely. And there was nothing else. But I didn't really look in literature for much of anything. I really, when I was a kid, thought that novels did an awful lot of lying about how people really felt. I didn't really understand that they were making social comments. I mean, I knew perfectly well that children didn't die so that we would be better people, as they do in Dickens, and I was very suspicious of literature, perhaps because I didn't find people or feelings that I could much identify with.
Well, then what made you want to write?
To tell the truth. Somebody had to.
Well, Jane Rule, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your life and your writing.
Thank you. It's been a lovely interview.
Jane Rule spoke to us from the CBC in Vancouver, Canada. Her new novel, Memory Board, is published by the Naiad Press in Tallahassee, Florida. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in with Robert Siegel, who hosts the program. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What's coming up?
We have a special report from reporter Frank Browning today. It tries to answer the question, how is it that not too long ago, reporters knew all about the sex lives of politicians but didn't tell, and nowadays everybody tells everything? We'll also hear from Jerusalem Post journalist Hirsch Goodman with his own proposal for how to get talks between Israel and Palestinians on the West Bank and Gaza going. And also we'll talk with Mike McKellar, jazz club owner in New York City. Do you know why his club was once shut down?
How come?
He was shut down for having too large a rhythm section. A law has been overturned in New York that used to prohibit you from having more than a trio.
Well, thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Critic Ken Tucker has a review of a new home video cartoon series. Now more Americans can watch The Adventures of Tintin.
The Adventures of Tintin is a unique comic strip created by the late Belgian artist Georges Rémy, who used the pen name Hergé. Tintin was a so-called boy reporter who, accompanied by his wire-haired terrier Snowy, traveled the world having adventures in 24 novel-length cartoon books. From the start in 1929, The Adventures of Tintin exerted an uncommonly broad appeal. The young man with the light bulb-shaped head and innocent eyes charmed millions of children throughout the world, but he also obsessed adults as serious as Winston Churchill and Charles de Gaulle, both of whom saluted the beautiful artistry and terse storytelling skills of Hergé. In 1962, some of Tintin's adventures were made into cartoons by the American producer Charles Schoes, and these are now available for the first time on videocassette.
Hey, what's that up ahead? Looks like an accident.
They've got the Bloomin' Road blocked.
Maybe we can help them. What seems to be the trouble, gentlemen?
You seems to be the trouble, Tintin.
Uh-oh. It's the man from the airport.
Right. I knew you would be here sooner or later.
Put away that pistol, sir, or I'll call a constable, I will.
You better call an ambulance. You'll need one.
Hey, you won't get away with this. I'll have both of you locked up.
That's an excerpt from The Black Island, one of the greatest Tintin comic books that comes across as rather mild in its video version. This video series, which also adapts Tintin books such as The Secret of the Unicorn and The Crab with the Golden Claw, does a good job of conveying the breathless pace of Tintin's adventures, but its limited animation cannot equal the lush colors and meticulous complexity of Hergé's comic strip panels. Little Brown has kept all the Tintin books in print in fine English translations. You should read those first. But younger viewers and older diehard fans may want to check out these earnest video cassettes. As you watch them, bear in mind that Tintin may soon see life in another medium. Steven Spielberg has bought the rights to make a movie with a live-action Tintin. Other new video cassette releases include the long-awaited arrival of Oliver Stone's Platoon, whose video debut has been postponed for months due to a wrangle by competing video companies over who had rights to the Oscar-winning war film. There's also RoboCop, director Paul Verhoeven's very violent, very witty science fiction thriller starring Peter Weller in the robot role he was born to play.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at the next fresh air. Next time, I'll speak with actress Zelda Rubinstein. After being cast as one of the little people in Under the Rainbow, she played the clairvoyant in Poltergeist. Now she's starring in the new horror film Anguish. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will profile the career of pianist and composer Paul Bley. And television critic David Bianculli will preview the 20th anniversary reunion of the cast from the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. Comic Steve Martin is back, along with musicians Glenn Campbell, John Hartford, and Jennifer Warnes. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.